Good morning, everybody. Steve wanted me to mention that 8:53 is going to be the song of invitation if you're inclined to use a book. And Ross wanted me to mention something that he forgot to, that there will be a bridal shower Sunday, August the 19th for the bride-elect of Dakota Jones here at the Netherland Church. So I'll make plans to be there. Words cannot adequately express how grateful we are to this church for the last couple of years. We are grateful to each and every one of you on a personal level. We're grateful for our elders. I'm thankful for Mark and what he's done in my life over the last couple of years. Grateful for Ross and his friendship, and I know that the future is bright at this church. I'm excited about who you're going to get in a couple of weeks. Brother Jeffer, I think, is a student of the Word, and I think will broaden the perspective of folks. I don't think there's any way that he could have thought when he was a little boy growing up in the Philippines that he would ever be here, but the Lord had that in mind. And so I'm grateful for that, and wanted to just thank you for the support that you've shown us in the things that we've tried to do. So keep praying for us. We start our new work very soon. Pray for us and pray for our family, and we're going to continue to pray for you. Of course, we'll be back some. I'll be back in a couple of weeks, and looking forward to that, I guess the second Sunday of September to fill in. We're going to be in Matthew chapter 20. If you got your Bibles, I would encourage you to turn there. There's a lengthy story there that we're going to read. But I want to borrow your imagination for just a minute. And I want you to put yourself at work. And I want you to imagine that your boss comes into you, your boss calls you into his office, his or her office. And what they say to you is, we're going to renegotiate your salary. And starting on January the 1st, you're going to make $100,000 a year. It sounds like a pretty good deal, right? But here's the catch. You're not going to get paid till the last day of the year. Now, you may not be inclined to do that, but if you could figure that out, it may be well worth your time to make, if that's extra money, to make that kind of money and get paid on the last day of the year. So you start. And you work hard. Somewhere along about June, your boss hires somebody else to help you. And so they come and they enter into a relationship at your company and they stand shoulder to shoulder with you. You don't know the terms of their contract. You don't know the terms of their compensation package. But you got some assumptions going on, right? And then somewhere along about September, another person comes, and they join your company, and they stand shoulder to shoulder with you. Now, you don't know what their compensation package is, but you've got some assumptions to make, right? You know that your deal was $100,000 for 1 year's worth of work, so you make some assumptions about these other folks. You like these other people. You're friends with these other people. They're friendly back to you. Everybody's getting along and it's going great. And then the last day of the year comes and your boss calls everybody into his office. And that person that started working about September goes up to the desk. And your boss says, "You've done such an exceptional job since September the 1st. Here's your pay." And your boss gives that person $100,000. What do you think? Well, at first you're thinking, well, I'm going to make some extra money, right? Because I put in some extra time. Then that person who started working in June strolls up to your boss's desk, says, "You've done such an exceptional job this the half of this year since June. I appreciate your hard work. I appreciate your effort and your ethics." And this person's got a smile on their face, and your boss gives that person a check for $100,000. What are you thinking? Then you go up to your boss's desk. Maybe that person was a moron and just didn't know it, right? and you're going to get paid extra. So you go up, you know your level of work, you know your level of involvement with the company, you know how hard you've worked, you've waited all year for this moment. You were promised $100,000. These other people who only worked half the amount of time made $100,000. You know what you are due, and your boss says, you've done such a good job. You've done an exceptional job. Here's your pay, $100,000. Is that fair? We can be honest as church. Is that fair? We're getting some mixed signals, right? It's what you agreed to. It's the terms of your contract. But does it feel fair? Matthew chapter 20, Jesus tells a similar story. This is what he says. He tells it better than I can. For the kingdom of heaven is like a master of a house who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them into his vineyard, and going out about the third hour, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace and said to them, you go into the vineyard too, and whatever is right, I will give you. So they went, going out again. About the sixth hour and the ninth hour, he did the same. And about the 11th hour, he went out and found others standing. And he said to them, why do you stand here idle all day? They said to him, because no one has hired us. He said to them, you go into the vineyard too. And when evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, call the laborers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last up to the first. And when those hired about the 11th hour came, each of them received a denarius. Now when those hired first came, they thought they would receive more, but each of them also received a denarius. And on receiving it, they grumbled at the master of the house, saying, these last worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat. But he replied to one of them, friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? Take what belongs to you and go. I chose to give to this last worker as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Or do you begrudge my generosity? So the last will be first, and the first will be last. But it doesn't feel fair, does it? It's been said that Christianity is supremely a religion of grace. And that's certainly true. But even so, grace is not well understood and often not really believed from the perspective of somebody else. I'm not sure that we understand grace from our own perspective to the fullness that we should, but we understand it even less when we see other people getting something from the Lord. That person that came to know the Lord late in life, or those folks that don't work as hard as I do yet receive the same benefit, we understand it less when it deals with other people. In his book, What's So Amazing About Grace, Philip Yancey points out that part of our problem is in the nature of grace itself. He says, and I'll never forget the term he uses, that grace is scandalous, specifically from the perspective of other people. It's hard to accept, hard to believe, and hard to receive. Grace shocks us sometimes in what it offers. It is truly not of this world. It frightens us with what it does for sinners. Grace teaches us that God does for others at times what we would never do for them. which is not only to forgive them, but empower them and heal them and love them. If you're like me, I'm comfortable with God saving the not so bad. Are you like me? But struggle when you hear those transformative stories about God saving the scandalous. Grace is a gift that costs everything to the giver and nothing to the receiver. But when it comes to grace and our feeling of grace, we want to receive it. But we're less in line when others receive it in a mighty way. It's given to those who don't deserve it, at times even barely recognize it, and from our perspective, maybe don't even appreciate it, because we work hard. Jesus does the work on the cross, right? Jesus is the one who pays the price. And yet, it is easy to feel justified when God offers the wage, to misuse that term, the same wage, to folks that we feel like do less than us. Do you know what I mean? This is Matthew chapter 20. It's what we agree to. But it doesn't feel fair, does it? God's grace cannot help even you until you are desperate enough to receive it. So I thought this week a little bit about what I wanted to share with you. And I thought that grace would be a good thing to talk about. I want to share with you two things, kind of built out of this story in Matthew chapter 20. Two attitudes, I think, that I see from this story that we need more of in the context of grace. And specifically, I'm talking to all of us Good Church Christ people. Okay? We like to work. And we need to work. I'm not saying that. But for those of us with a disposition of work and those of us that find it at times easy to look as if grace were scandalous, then this is especially for you. Grace can be uncomfortable, can it? When we think about the perspective of outsiders, no doubt the workers who have worked the longest were the most uncomfortable. And uncomfortable is a positive way of saying mad, right? Want to be positive, right? But if you work twice as long as somebody else and you get paid the same, aren't you a little mad? Aren't you going to go home and complain to your spouse? Do you ever do that? Aren't you going to say, that's not right? And Jesus knows it doesn't matter on the timeline when or where we live. Innate in our human DNA is the idea of what is fair and what is not. And Jesus tells this story on purpose, because He wants to take our idea of fairness and flip it on its head. Because here's the reality. For any of us, grace is not fair. Even if you worked all your life, you didn't earn it. Even if you are the best Church Christ person in the world, you did not earn it. You didn't. Grace can be uncomfortable. And no doubt that the workers who had worked the least amount felt a little uncomfortable too. Now put yourself in their place. In Jesus' story, they work an hour. But if you go back to the story that I told at the beginning, can you imagine what it would be like to work for 3 months and to look at the other folks who worked for 6 and 12 and you got paid what they got paid? I would run to the car and leave as quickly as possible, right? Because I don't want to have that conversation with people. I'm grateful, and I'm not giving the money back, but I'm going to hit the car. Do you know what I mean? I don't want to have that conversation. What would it have been like for them? You see, this is the thing to understand about grace. Not only is it uncomfortable when we see people receive that kind of grace, it's uncomfortable for them. When they have truly been transformed, when Jesus has got a hold of them, and they know. The truth of the story is, if I'm going to imitate my master and be truly gracious, it's going to make people uncomfortable. When's the last time that you made somebody uncomfortable because of your graciousness? I think about Jesus' interaction with prostitutes and tax collectors. I think about the woman at the well, the woman caught in adultery, the unclean woman, and Zacchaeus. No doubt how Jesus treated the worst of the worst, the least of these, made people uncomfortable. But in every situation, Jesus wanted to make the point that grace is not only for those that are not so bad, grace is also for the worst of the worst. But it's easy to hide from those folks, isn't it? And I'm as guilty as anybody. Is it possible that we have become so comfortable in our lives that we've forgotten what grace is? It is. It can be uncomfortable. But the fundamental truth of the matter is, I may not feel like I need as much grace as a murderer or a prostitute, but I still need it. And you still need it. And if we really need grace, if the not so bad needs grace, and the really bad needs grace, are we really that different? The second thing that I notice about grace in this story is that grace is always enough. No matter how hard you work, God's sustaining grace is always enough. Grace is enough. The workers may not have understood this fact, and they probably didn't. But what they received was not only what they agreed to, but it was enough. Grace always is. It is the sustaining force in the life of a believer, empowered by the Spirit. It is though that I think sometimes for us that we've been given a task to do, and sometimes we run out of energy and run out of patience and run out of mind. But God's grace is enough. Sometimes we approach a situation with all of the anticipation and excitement, but we end up failing. And how we feel after that isn't always the greatest, but grace is always enough. Sometimes we just mess things up with the best intentions. We think about that over and over and over and over and over again, and it eats us up from the inside out. But grace is always enough. Not only is it what the workers agreed to, it is what they needed, because it came from Jesus. And it's always enough. We sing songs like "Jesus Loves Me, This I Know," "For the Bible Tells Me So," "Amazing Grace," "How Sweet the Sound." But we just scratch at the surface what that really means. That grace is enough. When you think about yourself, do you see yourself as a laborer in God's vineyard? Or do you see yourself as not good enough? When you look at yourself and think about yourself, do you see yourself as a worker on behalf of God Most High? Or do you see yourself as a mess up? Or as somebody who could never do those kinds of things? Jesus goes around in the story and he invites people into his vineyard. He invites people onto the farm, right? Folks who seemingly don't have anything else going on. Folks who don't even have jobs. And invites them to partake in this kingdom building work. It doesn't matter what you do for a living, you can be a laborer in his vineyard. And what he offers to give you is enough. Whether you work for the rest of your life or the last day of your life, what he gives you is enough. Sometimes when we think about grace, we think that God just kind of turns his head, holds his nose, and lets us by. That's not grace. That's not what the songwriter had in mind for Amazing Grace. That's not what Jesus thinks about when he talks about grace. God doesn't just hold his nose and let you pass into the great beyond. What God does in turn is sees you for who you are and empowers you to be better, to do greater, to be healed, to be forgiven, but to be transformed, and then to work. Not so that you would get more transformation, but because you have been transformed. Paul says it this way in Ephesians chapter 3, "For this reason I bow my knees before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth is named, that according to the riches of his glory, he may grant you to be strengthened with power through his Spirit in your inner being, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may have strength to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth and length and height and depth, and to know the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge." Now to him who is able to do more. Paul says a whole lot. But he says the most important thing you can know, the thing that you can build life on, that God can breathe into your existence, the fundamental truth is to know the love of God. That's it. That's it. To know what Christ has done for you and then to build on top of that. Do you really want to understand life? The only way to understand life in general is to know the riches of his glory and the love of Christ. Why is that? Because if you don't understand that, even all the good works that you do will never be built on the right foundation. If you build a life of good and build it anywhere else other than the love of Jesus and the grace of God, that life will falter. It will fall. And the more that you understand the grace of God and the more that you understand the love of Jesus, the better the building in life is. Now, I know that that gets off close to being a church answer. That's harder to find, but I'm telling you this morning that if you will seek to know Jesus, that if you will dig into his grace, that if you don't worry so much about what other people get, but you focus on what you've been given and on what you can give to other people, that not only will you feel God's love and God's grace more, but the more that life will make sense. Your inner self is being strengthened. How? By the grace of God. Your relationships are being strengthened. How? By the strength that comes in your inner person because of the grace of God. The church makes sense. How? Because we understand in our inner person the grace of God. It's the key to it all. It's the first fruit of God's work in the world today. What you do matters. How you live matters. We typically think this way. Yes, I believe in God's grace, but I've also got to live a good life. And so there's this intrinsic idea of earning salary and wages and worth. And when we don't feel worthy enough, when we've made some mistakes along the way, who's the first person that we tend to leave? But I want you to consider this. I want you to try to think about it this way. Think about the same equation, but from a different order. If God's grace wasn't real, if God's grace didn't exist, it would not matter how good your life is. It wouldn't ever be good enough. So we always think, yeah, God's got grace, but I've got to do all this stuff too. No, listen, you could do all that stuff, and if God's grace wasn't real, all that stuff doesn't matter. Because it's never going to be good enough. God's grace is enough. By itself. Alone. Because it's grace that changes the trajectory of everything. Lines us up for more and more. Take the pressure off of yourself. Line yourself up into that pool and jump in. Silas has gotten into this habit. This won't surprise any of you. Silas has gotten into this habit of before he does anything, he says, cannonball. So if he gets out of the car, he says, cannonball, and jumps into the parking lot. When he takes a bath, he stands up on the edge of the tub and says, cannonball, and jumps into the tub, right? Water gets everywhere. When he gets into bed, he jumps onto the bed and says, cannonball, right? And jumps on the bed. What would it be like to do a cannonball in God's grace? What would that look like? To do a cannonball. To try to make the biggest splash. You ever do that at the swimming pool? Who can make the biggest splash? What if we tried to make the biggest splash in the pool of God's grace for ourselves and for others? God's grace is free. And so we never want to leave an opportunity without offering you the freedom of that choice to accept what is free, what has been freely given. And so we offer the invitation now. If you're here and you've never experienced God's grace, come and do a cannonball. In two ways, right? Figuratively and literally. In the water. I know a lot of us have already done that. We've already made that confession. We've taken those steps of faith. We give you this time to respond in some way. If you need some prayers, if you need some love, if you need some encouragement, God's grace is real for you too. And it can be experienced again. If we can help you, let us know what we can do while together we stand and while we sing.